My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I am a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have not found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink, since January 25th, 1981. Yes, that's right. And not a record around here, but a record for me. And it's good to be here. It's always a pleasure and a great privilege to be asked to do something like this, and it keeps me out of trouble. Because, you know, idle hands are the devil's workshop. And so one of the tools and one of the good things you can do, besides studying the big book, from in my case, studying the Bible, hanging around godly people, I think people who are on the same path, seeking him and helping others and helping other people, is doing something like this. You know, because otherwise you're just sitting around and thinking about bad stuff, probably having something to do with yourself. And so it's always good for me to do something like this. I get a lot out of it. I don't do a whole lot of preparing. You know, I guess I've been preparing for this for, I guess I'm 63 years old. And I've been sober a little over 31 years or something like that. I'm not even sure. And raised four kids and six grandchildren and married 31 years And I've done a lot of these meetings. I've read this book a lot. And I'm always willing to learn. I'm like these guys. I know but a little. I must not know much because all the guys I sponsor always tell me I don't understand. So I've gotten apparently progressively dumber as time goes by. This is about my experience, my strength. And if our stories disclose in a general way, our stories are what's important. This is my story. It doesn't have to be your story. I'm not trying to force this on anybody. You don't have to buy any of it. And it's like what you like, take, and what you don't like, it's fine. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to do what I'm paid to do at these exorbitant fees. I'm going to do the best I can to be transparent. You know, if you don't like it and I piss you off and you're mad at me, then I've accomplished something. I've accomplished what I want to accomplish. Because when you throw a rock into a pack of dogs, the one that yelps the loudest is the one that's hit. And our spiritual axiom is whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the problem, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. So if you believe not in your own brain, in your own way of thinking, but if you believe in our book, and if you believe in our program, and something I say pisses you off, even though you think I'm the cause, I've given you something to look at about yourself. Because I can tell you this, if your sobriety is so small that something I say can bother you, you're not going to do well in the world for the next 20 years. Because I'm just talking about my story. But maybe if you find out what it is that's bothering you and you get over it, maybe you'll do a little bit better with not only with clowns like me, but maybe out there in the world. So I guess part of my job is to tick people off, or, you know, what do they say? You know, comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. So in any event, I want to talk a little bit. We're sort of around step two, but don't hold me to that. You know, I'm not going to restrain myself. I'm going to go wherever I think the Spirit leads me, and I want to talk a little bit about what they tell me I'm supposed to talk about on page 29. I'm a devotee of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in this book. I don't believe much in my own brain. And this is what the big book says. It says on the preface, it says, because this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such a large number of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a strong sentiment against any radical changes. So there haven't really been any changes. There were a couple of changes. Like in the first time they published this, they said the only desire for membership, we don't have much rules for membership, but the only desire for membership was an honest desire to stay sober. And that was like a little bit too tough for alcoholics. Little bit too tough. So they took out the word honest. A fleeting thought, what the hell, I got nothing else to do tonight, is enough. So, you know, but you want to know something? It is still a requirement, the desire to stop drinking. And I'll tell you, you don't appreciate. I mean, we do have, it may be a minor requirement, it may be a small requirement, a desire to stop drinking, but you won't appreciate that requirement until you're eating in a meeting with someone who really doesn't want to stay sober. And watch the way he disrupts the meeting. And watch the way he laughs at people. And watch the way he mocks and disrupts your situation. Then you'll realize there's a reason why we even have that small thing. Because at least we presume that if you're here tonight, maybe it's not honest, but you're here to hear something because you really want to do something about your drinking. So it may not be much of a deal, but it's the deal we have, you know, and it's the lowest filter we could probably think of. Now, in the good old days, the days I kind of like, wish we could sort of go back to, but that's okay. I'm a little hardcore. When they used to take you up in the upper room and you have to give your life to Jesus, and then they get let you down in the meeting, they'd have what's called, what they have in Dr. Bob in the good old times, a real surrender. Well, I'll tell you, it was a real qualifier. I bet you didn't have much problems on the third step in those meetings, huh? Can you imagine that? I mean, when they had you go upstairs and get on your knees in front of a bunch of men and give your life to God, and then they'd allow you down in the meeting, you didn't have too many people, at meetings talk about the third step, saying, well, I don't believe in that. So it was a real qualifier. It's sort of like got everybody sort of strained in. I'm not saying we should go to that or anything like that, but there's a great power, you know, later on when you hopefully progress through, you know, A is sort of like a spiritual kindergarten. We come in here all pissed off about God and all sorts of stuff. We don't want anything shoved down our throat and everything like that. And as you progress and you get older and wiser in this thing, and you decide instead of being right all the time, you'd rather be happy. And you'd rather be at peace with yourself and somebody else, and you stop growing up and stop fighting the world and everything around you. And you start realizing that your best thing got you in here, and you're probably not as smart as you think you are. Start hanging around men that seem to be doing okay and not pissing and moaning and not thumb-sucking crybabies. You understand that even though the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking, there's a different requirement in order to join the fellowship of the Spirit that they talk about in vision for you. There's another fellowship in here. There's a lot of fellowships in AA. There's not just the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Within Alcoholics Anonymous, there's different fellowships. One of the fellowships they talk about is the fellowship of the Spirit. They say you'll surely meet some of us as you travel the road to happy destiny. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. What I'm really interested in is talking about the next frontier, emotional sobriety. You know, Bill Wilson said, he said, that's the real deal. You know, he said what alcoholics really suffer from is unhealthy dependencies. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, because although I love newcomers and I sponsor newcomers, and it's a wonderful thing to not only be a newcomer but to be involved with newcomers, I have a real heart for old, I won't say, people who have been around for a while that haven't quite grasped this thing. You know, people who have, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys that have 26, 27, you know, 28 years sobriety, 22 years sobriety, 18, 16. You know, at times they may be the guys with the longest time in AA rooms, and they're living lives of quiet desperation. And if you sponsor a lot of people and you've been around for a long time, you start realizing how many people drink after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. You know, they say 0.5% makes more than 20 years. And even the people that are sober 20 or 25 years, but they walk around, they have chips on their shoulders, or they're lonely, or they're upset, and you see that sort of stuff. And so I have a great heart for men like that. And so I'm going to talk, I'm not going to talk really at a basic level, you know, to the extent, I'm not going to make believe I'm talking just to newcomers. The funny thing is I find that, you know, old timers, when I say old timers, there's a lot of people that when you're a little tough or you talk a little bit about basics and everything, you got a lot of people who say, well, you'll scare away the newcomers. But it's been my experience that sometimes the newcomers really enjoy it the most, because they're in here for a message of a real, they say depth and weight. They're not here to be bullshitted around, you know. So I'm going to basically try to be transparent, talk about myself. It says on page 29, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories, this is sort of like this is really my personal story, my sojourn through the steps, describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. I want to read that again. This is our basic text. This is the thing we're supposed to all agree on. Now, the problem with alcoholics, and I told you about this last week, and I told you a story about my first wife, where she told me, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Now, it bears repeating this story. I think every time I talk, it bears repeating this story, because it tells me something about myself and about the nature of the disease of alcoholism. We all know that, really, alcohol is not the problem. if you're new in here and you think, well, Alcoholics Anonymous, the word alcohol is in the name, I came here because I wanted to stop drinking, that's why I came here, because I wanted to stop drinking, you tend to think that alcohol is the problem. And, you know, now that I'm not drinking, everything's going to be okay. Now, if you've been around here for a while, you learn that once you stop drinking, after a few months, you learn why you drank in the first place. And you understand that alcohol really isn't the problem. Alcohol is but a symptom of the problem. A person who drinks to excess over and over again and cannot stop, that's a symptom of the problem. The real problem centers in our mind, not our body. And the real problem goes on. Alcoholism goes on even after you stop drinking. And that men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Because they're restless, irritable, and discontented. They are in a state of dis-ease unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. It doesn't matter whether they have money, they don't have money, they're going out, they're not going out, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is, in the end, it all leads to who the hell they think they're screwing with. It all leads to bad thinking about yourself and other people, broken marriages, broken relationships, because we're broken people. Because we cannot live. My problem was, I drank because I was awake. And if you're awake and sober, you got a problem. Because alcoholism thrives on sobriety. It thrives on sobriety. It loves you to be sober. The one thing alcoholism would love you to be is not drinking. So it could really have its way with you. So it could really tell you that guy's a piece of crap and who the hell they think they're dealing with. And they don't know who they're screwing with. And, you know, I'm on top of the world. I'm a piece of crap. So you can start thinking the way you like to think. Being pissed off the way you like being pissed off. Thinking about how unfair the world is. You know, comparing your inside to other people's outsides. Feeling that you're a victim. Getting involved in self-pity and all judgment and all the stuff that we get involved in here. And that's why I drank. I drank, you know, for the noble art of getting Bob, because I never wanted to feel the way I felt. And somehow drinking fixed me up and helped me and worked better than any woman or car or boat or money or anything, and as long as it was working, I was going to drink it, and alcohol stopped working for me, and no, it's okay, you know, oh, that happens, you know, Fred, don't worry about it, no big deal.
We're going to have to talk to you after, you know, the meeting.
No, no, it's just I'm 63, now I got to start all over again. You know, your kids won't understand, but, you know, don't mess with a 63-year-old brain. It's a bad deal, you know. Look, when I came in here, I had only two neurons working. They were waving goodbye at each other, you know. So, I mean, so in any event, I want to talk about what happened to me, and I'm going to read a couple things. But, hey, I'm going to start off with a joke, which may have something to do with the second step, maybe not. And you've probably heard it before if you've been through my step series. I repeat 99%. Repetition is good. Yeah. Repetition is real good. Reading the big book over and over again is real good. You know, if you read the big book 1,000 times over a period of 20 years, one day you're going to remember something. One day you're going to see something that you've never seen before. You know, the stuff we learn in here is generally stuff that we heard 20 years ago, 50,000 times, and all of a sudden we hear it for the first time because something happens in our life, something changes. We hear somebody say it a certain way, and all of a sudden we say, man, don't drink, go to meetings. Yeah. I was 5 years sober when I was whining to my sponsor once again because I joined the Fellowship of the Thumbsucking Crybabies. I was in the Fellowship of the Thumbsucking Crybabies, sober, but I was in the Fellowship of the Thumbsucking Crybabies for about 10 or 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, if you were around me, I was going to complain about something, you know, because things weren't going my way. And I was talking to my sponsor one day, and I was 5 years sober, and I started repeating what I had been repeating. You know, for the last 5 years, there was some sort of problem, and I was upset and telling him about it. And he said to me the same stupid thing he said to me all the time because he just didn't understand. And like me, my sponsor wasn't that bright, you know, and I kept on telling him what the problem was. It was money. It was my wife. It was my boss. And he kept on saying the same old crap over and over again, which had nothing to do with my problem. And finally, once again, I started whining about my problem, and he said the same stupid thing he had always said. He said, how many meetings have you gone to? Did you go to a meeting yesterday? I wasn't talking about meetings. I was talking about money, you know what I mean? And he asked me, how many did you go to a meeting yesterday? He would always ask these yes and no questions. Life is just more complicated than that. And I said, well, no, I didn't go to a meeting yesterday. And then he said, I guess the same thing he's been saying to me for five flipping years. He said, Russell, when you go to meetings, you feel good. When you don't go to meetings, you don't feel so good. And I don't know what it was. It was 5 years of hearing that over and over again, but I walked out of there and says, when you go to a meeting, you feel good. When you don't go to meetings, you don't feel so good. This is complex stuff, you know? When you go to meetings, you feel good. When you don't go to a meeting, see, I've been trying to figure out how to balance my life. I had explained to him that I don't have to go to meetings on Thursdays. You know, I had explained to him that I'd already been to a meeting last Monday, and, you know, trying to figure out how to stay sober with as little meetings as possible because I had important things to do. And all of a sudden, you go to a meeting, you feel good. You don't go to a meeting, and somehow I started thinking, I says, if I go to meetings, you feel, and I started going to a meeting every day. I just start going to a meeting every day. Sometimes I'd go two times a day. So I stopped counting my meetings. I just go to meetings. And all of a sudden, I started feeling great. Yeah, I started feeling great. It only took me 5 years to figure that one out. 5 years of sobriety. So my wife says to me, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. This is before I got sober. And I'm 26 years old, 25 years old. I'm a division chief in the state attorney's office trying multiple murder cases and all that sort of stuff and all that heady stuff. I'm in charge of four or five other attorneys. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning. I was more sober and certainly smarter than I am right now. And had a beautiful wife and a beautiful child. And I walk out of my house and you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. She said it as clear as a bell. And she was serious. And I got in my car and I drove two blocks. Stopped at the line, and I remember thinking, what the hell did she mean by that? And the spiritual axiom, or the axiom I get from that, is whenever an alcoholic hears, sees, or is told something he doesn't like or doesn't agree with, it pisses him off and confuses him. And he will somehow, some way, try to get around it. He'll either scratch that person off his list, you know what I mean, or walk the other way, or say it doesn't exist. And that's when I understood for the first time that even though I may have read this big book, 90% of it I probably X'd out. By the time I was done reading it, what I thought it said is, you know, acceptance is the answer to all my problems, which is, to a certain extent, the truth, and was very helpful for me for years. But if that was true, if acceptance was the answer to all my problems, we wouldn't need a big book. All we need is like a matchbook cover, a bumper sticker. And I had skipped all that part, the parts that I didn't like. What I did was, even though this is the basic text, even though what's in here is the basic text, the bottom line is I read the stuff that I understood and I liked, and I threw away the stuff I didn't like. And what happened was, as my life went on, and things got rough in different ways, and I got pummeled by life, and, you know, the six steps started hitting me, and the seven steps started hitting me, you know, we learned the value of suffering. And if you think it takes a lot of suffering, and a lot of being hit over the head to finally admit you got a problem with alcohol. You know, the first step in getting out of jail is knowing you're in jail in the first place. You would amaze how much suffering it's, and you know, how many times did I say it's, you know, I don't have a problem with alcohol? How long did I believe that my drinking didn't hurt anybody but me? Or my drinking didn't hurt anybody at all? Or nobody drinks, everybody drinks exactly like me. How many lies did I tell myself while my marriage was falling apart, while my soul was falling apart, to make myself believe that I was perfectly okay and it was the world? How many years did I go through that, you know, hurting people, screwing up my life? How much money did I blow before I finally got to the point, because I was on my knees, not because I was smart, because I lost everything, including my self-respect, before I looked the man in the eye and said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. Well, how much do you think that sort of thinking just goes away? You think it has to do with alcohol? You don't think it has to do with spending money on your charge cards that you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like? You don't think it has to do with sniffing around and running around the planet Earth if you're a guy trying to look for a gal because you're convinced that women are the answer to all your problems, or being a gal and looking around and being convinced that a man is the answer to all your problems? You don't think it has to do with material things? You don't think you suffer from this alcoholism in different forms, that alcohol takes different forms and your addiction takes different forms and your dependencies take different forms on 1,000 different things that you like that make you feel better, that basically kill you in the end and disturb your life? And if people try to get in the way and try to tell you that that's the problem, you don't think you do the same thing, cross them off your list and say they're crazy and they're stupid and go through your entire, how many years do you, what, until you're 50, 60, 70, maybe on your deathbed, you say, I blew the whole thing? How much of that alcoholism do you think you suffer now because you're worried about women or men or him or her or cars or jobs or focuses on crap that means absolutely nothing? And being convinced because of your alcoholic mind, somehow constructing the world in such a way so that you must be right and I must be wrong because you watch TV and everybody else is doing it that way and you don't do it differently than anybody else and they're all sick. So alcoholism is alive and well in sobriety even if you're not drinking. Blocks you from the joy of living. Blocks you from being experiencing much of heaven, being rocking in the fourth dimension of existence, which you're not even dreaming. They don't talk about an A means, because an A means is just pick up a chip, pick up a medallion. There's nothing wrong with that. We celebrate not drinking. We celebrate not drinking. But not drinking is just the ante in this poker game. So here's the deal. So the $10 trip to the Bahamas. So you guys heard about this, right? So there's this shack, this place. They had the sign. It said, $10 trip to the Bahamas. So the guy walks in. He sees a $10 trip to the Bahamas. Cruise to the Bahamas, $10. You know, I've been on cruise to the Bahamas. It was like $800, $900. This is a $10 cruise to the Bahamas. So the guy walks in. He says, you got a sign on the wall. It says, $10 cruise to the Bahamas. I mean, if you've heard this, don't get ahead of me, you know. Don't. So he says, is that true? He says, absolutely. $10 cruise to the Bahamas. Absolutely. $10, that's all. Absolutely. You mean to tell me, I give you $10 and I get a cruise to the Bahamas? No question. An entire cruise. I get a cruise to the Bahamas. Cruise to the Bahamas, $10. He says, you're not kidding me. He says, that's it. He said, cruise to the Bahamas. He says, you got $10? He says, absolutely. He says, give it to me. You're on the cruise. We got one living right now. He says, you're kidding. You got $10? He says, give me the $10. Guy gives him $10. Immediately, he gets whacked upside the head and he goes unconscious. Sometime later, he comes out of a haze. You know, he doesn't know whether it's hours or days or whatever. He comes out of a haze and he finds himself floating on an inner tube in the Atlantic Ocean. There's no land in sight, but he seems to be, you know, the sun is going down in the west. He seems to be floating towards the Bahamas. He's looking around. There's no land. He says, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe this is happening. And ahead about 100 yards, he sees a guy in a baseball cap also floating in an inner tube. So as quickly as possible, he paddles to the guy with the baseball cap on the inner tube, and he says, Do you believe this? I go into this place, a $10 cruise, I give the guy $10, I get whacked on the head, now I'm in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, middle of the Gulf Stream, I'm going to die out here, there's no land, what's going on, this is crazy. The guy with the baseball cap says, You're telling me? You know, and he says, I can't believe, how can they be allowed to get away with this? I mean, people are going to die. We're going to die out here. We don't even know where we are, what's going on. The guy with the baseball cap says, you're telling me? You're telling me? He says, I don't believe this has happened. So now these two guys are sort of like floating together in the middle of the Atlantic. And after about, 15 minutes, the guy turns to the guy with the baseball cap and he says, you think they feed us on this cruise? And the guy in the baseball cap says, I don't know, they didn't last year. it is kind of funny. You know what? How can somebody be so stupid as to do something idiotic like that again? That's funny when you hear somebody so stupid that when they would do something stupid a second time. That's us, right? That's a story about us. That's the disease you're dealing with. That's what you're dealing with. They're all laughing at us. We're the guys in the inner tube with the baseball cap. When you get what you want in your struggle for pelf and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that guy has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass, for the fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the guy staring back in the glass. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear up to the end, and you've passed your most dangerous, difficult test if the guy in the glass is your friend. You may be like Jack Horner and chisel a plum and think you're a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. You can fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the guy in the glass. You know, you don't want to get to the end of this deal and realize that you've missed the entire banquet. You've missed the entire show. You've missed the whole deal, you know. You know, as I'm preparing for this and I'm thinking about the second step and, you know, I always think about the third step. And, of course, as you know, I'm a big believer in seek him. You know, that's the A's and C's. We don't manage our own lives, can't do it. No human power can relieve our alcoholism. Only God could and would if he was sought. It says, you know, he's the one who has all power. You know, he is the one, not us. We pray that you find him now. I think they were serious. Throughout this whole book, they talk about him. They talk about him, and the great fact, they say it's just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which revolutionize our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central factor of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator lives in our hearts and minds in a way which is indeed miraculous. He is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. This is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is our basic text. This is our basic text. There's been no change in it. I believe in the words. God could and would if he were sought. I believe in what they say in this book. I believe what they say in chapter 5 when they say, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, he does not enable us. He enables us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize for God. We never apologize for God. I never apologize. I'm not ashamed of God. I'm not ashamed of the power of God that lifted me from a sloppy drunk that hated himself to the person I am today. I'm not ashamed of that power. I don't worry about what other people think about me because I talk about that power. That power, the other people are not my higher power. The trustees of Alcoholics Anonymous are not my higher power. The Carl Gables group, as much as I like it, I've been a member of many groups, so they're not my higher power. That doorknob is not my higher power. The tree over there is not my higher power. The thing, when I got down, when I looked up to the, and I said, God help me, not even knowing who God was, God help me, and I was lifted from that scrap heap, I wasn't looking at, the bagel. It wasn't my sponsor that was my higher power. Now, my higher power may have lived and resided, and my sponsor may have been the image and likeness. You know, that's what the sixth step is. That's what separates the men from the boys. Somebody who repeatedly tries to grow in the image and likeness of his creator. That's what you call him. But I know who my higher power was. It was the guy I was talking to that day when I said, please save me. So I'm not ashamed of that power. I'm not ashamed to talk about that power in any AA groups. I don't worry about the guys that are snickering in the back of the room because one of the things that AA has given me is I've lost the fear of people. I'm no longer somebody that runs things through the filter. What will they think about me? I'm more concerned about what God will think about me and what I think about myself. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. I never apologize for that stuff. This is the power. I never apologize for a book that says we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I understand the book that has a chapter specifically to the atheists. One chapter is to the atheists. The rest of the chapter is only devoted to the believers. One chapter to the atheists. And the only thing that chapter says when you boil it right down, right in the middle of the chapter, is it says this sort of thinking has to be abandoned. I never make believe this book says something that it doesn't, because if it doesn't say that, it makes me uncomfortable, so I change the words. I don't do that. I don't get to the end of this book and read it as something else the way I like it and avoid or hate the stuff I don't like because I'm saying to myself, I wonder what they meant by that. I don't do what I did with my ex-wife when she told me specifically, plainly, you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you, and then make believe she didn't say what she said or I didn't understand what she said because I didn't want to understand what she said and saying, I wonder what she meant by that, making believe I was confused at those words when I wasn't confused at all. I just didn't want to do it. So when they say God is the one who has all power, may you find him now. And they didn't say higher power is the answer. This God is the answer. May you have find him now. I know exactly what they're talking about. And when Dr. Bob, who was not scared of this deal, Bill Wilson was a little funny about it. Even though in Bill Dodson, the story about Bill Dodson, he says in Bill Dodson's story, as you all know, in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, I'm not making this stuff up. You can look at it. He says, Bill Dodson says, it would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, or something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't gotten. I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seem to have. Bill looked, and he was talking about something more than just alcohol. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, Henrietta, this is what Bill Wilson said, the Lord, capital L, the Lord, we all know what he was talking about, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. Bill Wilson knew exactly what he was talking about because he was in a hospital room and the whole room lit up, and he said, so this is the creator. This is the God of the prophets. And he came out of the Oxford group. As you know, he was talking to Sam Shoemaker. You know what he knows what he was talking about. All these guys studied the Bible. I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he'd been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it, and he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep telling people about it, has been a sort of AA text, a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. That's what Bill Wilson said. Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, who went on, who grabbed that thing and ran with it. 4 months later, Bill Wilson was telling Henrietta Zibberline, maybe we shouldn't talk so much about God. Because some banana in an AA meeting started looking funny at Bill Wilson when he talked about God, and Bill Wilson started doubting himself. Because Bill Wilson, believe it or not, wasn't God, he was an alcoholic. And as an alcoholic, what he was more worried about than anything else is, what if people laugh at me? Because unlike you guys, who I can see as a cut above, he was worried about being humiliated in front of people. He would sell his life, his children, anything down the drain, as long as his boss would like him, or people wouldn't laugh at him. Because he felt so low about himself that the most important thing, he judged himself by what other people thought about him. He had no self-esteem. He had no God esteem. His esteem was based on what you thought about him in his eyes, which is why he was such a braggart. But Dr. Bob was a little bit different than Bill. Dr. Bob was the guy whose story is in here, was in the first part, who says this. And as I was thinking about this deal, you know, I'm sort of putting together what I want to talk about as far as step two is concerned. I started thinking about this thing that Dr. Bob said. What keeps people, why is it that people in AA, why is it that people in general are scared of the God thing, don't want to hear about the God thing? Even though the big book says we lose prejudice even against organized religion when you begin to see religious people are right. Even though the big book is so clear, even though the steps are so clear, why is there such an animosity? Why are people so scared, even in AA meetings, to mention God because they're scared some alcoholic's going to spank them? You know, I don't know when I learned, maybe it was at 20 years or 22 years, that no matter what I said, Jesus, God, whatever I said, that they can't kick me out of here. I don't know when I learned that they can't, like, pull my ticket, that New York wasn't going to come down and say, you can't go to AA anymore. You know, I don't know when I stopped worrying about what they thought about, what the group's going to think about. I don't know when that happened. Maybe you got to have a lot of time just to get over that crap, that fear of people and of economic insecurity. I asked Ray O'Keefe one time, when am I going to get over that, you know, when am I going to be economically insecure? He said, never. He said, it says I'm going to be economically insecure. He says, it's, he says, you'll lose the fear. You'll always be broke, but you'll be happy with that. I don't know, when do you grow up in here and stop being like the guy in the glass and start being able to look at yourself in the mirror and not worry so much about what other people think about you? You know, when, so you can be your own man. And not die, having never lived your life, always worrying about what will other people think about you if you do this or you do that or you say this or you say that. For God's sakes, Alcoholics and AA. Oh, my God. And then it led me to this chapter, and I started thinking, because what happens is, as you grow older, you know, I was spiritually blind. You know, it says in 1 Corinthians 13, as you know, that's, as you, I'm sure you know, reading Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, that's one of the three books that they felt were the bedstone, the bedrock, fundamentally essential for Alcoholics Anonymous, the first people who started this thing. The three books were Sermon on the Mount, the Book of James, and 1 Corinthians 13. As you know, in 1 Corinthians 13, the Apostle Paul says, we see through a glass. When I was a child, I thought like a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. Put childish things away. We see through a glass darkly, but soon things clear up. As you, when you're spiritually blind, this world, as much as it runs by material laws, there are spiritual laws. And when you violate spiritual laws, you get hurt spiritually. And when you're spiritually blind, you bump into the furniture of the world, and you fall into ditches, and bad things happen to you, and you screw up, and you don't even know why. As things start clearing up for you spiritually, you start seeing things in the world. You start becoming spiritually discerning. You discern things. In the big book, they call it inspirational thinking. Initially, they say, it only happens once in a while. You do all such crazy things, but then it says we come to rely on it. And when you get involved in spiritual thinking, when spiritual blindness goes away, and you start being run by the Spirit and not by basically your own motivations, all of a sudden you're making moves and you're thinking thoughts and you're doing things you don't even know where it's coming from. You know, you can even do AA meetings and not prepare that much. You can even talk faster because you're not talking from your own brain. You're talking from some other deal. You know, I can't explain that to you unless you've been through it or unless you've seen things. You've got to hang around AA and see some things. And so you start connecting dots and things that didn't make any sense. All of a sudden you see relationships between this, that, and the other thing. And you see relationships between the steps. And you see how God and faith in God runs all through the steps. And you can't explain to somebody because they don't see it. They just don't see it because they have to be spiritually discerned. They're not mature enough to see it. You have to take it on blind faith. And so I was reading on page 181 this statement by Dr. Bob, and I was trying to figure out why it is that people are so have such a problem, why alcoholics have such a problem with this. And I started linking the statement with Dr. Bob up with a story. And I'm going to take the last few minutes to talk about something called pride. And I'm not talking about pride like I'm proud of my son, or I'm proud of you, or I'm proud of a sponsee. I'm talking about something called false pride. False pride. It's a sin. It's a problem. And I want to tell you a little bit about false pride. In order to tell that, I'm going to tell you a little story about myself, and I'm going to read you something Dr. Bob said. When I was about 10 or 11 years old, I lived in New York, and when you're a 10-year-old kid, or year-old kid, or 12 or 13-year-old kid, boy, I don't know anything about the girl thing. What guys really look for is guys who are like athletes. They don't care whether you're the brightest kid in the block or you're smart. As a matter of fact, they make fun of you if you buy it. They care about like athletes. And we used to gather up, and I've always been, forever, like the worst athlete. The worst the worst jock, whatever it is. And we would gather up down below at the baseball field, and we'd choose up sides. And you get like these 10, 12, 15 guys. And you'd have two captains. They're always the guys who are the best, right? And they would. And you got the guys in the middle, and the Joe would say, well, I'll take Fred. And the other would say, well, I'll take Charlie. I'll take this one. I'll take that one. And as they're choosing people, that they go over to each side to make the teams. Has anybody been through this except for me? The guys in the middle, it's getting smaller and smaller. So I'd be one of the guys in the middle. And, you know, I'd be praying. It's funny how things get really scary. You start praying even if you don't believe in God, you know, when the heat gets on. I'd be praying, God, please don't let me be last. Please don't. I remember there were times I was chosen second to last. It was when I won the Academy Award. You know? Man, I was a cheap date, you know. Second to last, oh my God, you know. And it seems to me, though, I was almost always chose last. And you know, when they choose you last, you're standing there in the middle of the deal, like naked, and you know, there's nothing, you can't run, you can't, and they always say things like, oh, do we have to have them? Or like, they'd rather play with one less, you know what I mean? And you know what would happen to me at that time, if you've ever been in that situation, what happens is it's so embarrassing that I know I'm not God, because I would pray that they would blow up, I would blow up, I would disappear. And the only thing that happened, it was almost like a protective mechanism, is I would start, even though I was dying on the inside and crying on the inside, I would start, like, somehow I knew that if they saw me crying, or they knew they hurt me, something would happen, something terrible would happen. I don't know what it was. I couldn't allow them to see what was going on. So I would, like, laugh. As they were laughing at me, I would laugh like I was standing over there with them. Like it was fun, you know, like it was fun. I would make believe that I wasn't hurt, that it was funny. And you know, and then I would somehow be protected, make believe that I was like with them laughing at me. And somehow, and that thing that was a natural protection for me to act completely opposite of the way I felt, how did I know that that was going to build up a wall that was going to become 3 feet thick so that I would never let anybody know really what I felt? Really what I felt, and by the time I was 18, 20 years old, nobody could ever get in there. And as a matter of fact, here's the real scary thing. Not only would anybody ever know how I felt, I didn't even know how I felt. I didn't even know why I was pissed off. I didn't even know what was hurting me. I was lying to myself. And the reason for that is because one of my deepest fears, and it comes out in the force of a lot, is being humiliated in front of people, being laughed at. And so what I find, whether I know it or not, almost subconsciously, living my entire life, doing anything I can to avoid the possibility that somebody would laugh at me. Not going for jobs that maybe I was qualified for because what if they would laugh at me? Not raising my hand in class when I knew the answer because what if I was wrong? You know, not doing a million things, not saying stuff, not doing stuff for anything because what if somebody didn't like it or somebody wasn't scared enough? And not even knowing that that was how I was doing it. I just didn't want to do it. I just didn't feel like doing it. Not even know that my entire life was circumscribed by this fear that I didn't even know I had because I didn't want to go farther and I'd see other people doing something. Why can't I do that? Why can't I run for class president? Why can't I do that? Because there was some sort of fear blocking me. And so I read this thing that Dr. Bob says. And that's part and parcel, by the way, your alcoholism. But they don't arrest you for driving while being an idiot. They don't arrest you for driving while being in fear. They don't say, get out of your car. We noticed that you're scared shitless. Step on the fear. step on the flip fearometer. You know what I mean? They don't arrest you for that stuff, do you? So this is what Dr. Bob says. On page 181, if you think you are an atheist, you know, I'm not saying this. You want to get mad at me? I'm just the messenger. I'm just the guy who's highlighting this stuff. It's in the book, in our basic text. You know, this is our, you ever say, I get the guy who says, man, if I could only be sponsored by Dr. Bob and Bill, you wouldn't make it. They wanted to talk about God. They read the Psalms. They read the Bible. They met for quiet times. They didn't think religious people were goofs. You know, you hear people say, well, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. Well, that's funny. You know, what are you bragging? You're like bragging about that? In the big book, it says we lose all prejudice. It even says we encourage church membership. You're bragging. You think that's somehow a sign of recovery, that you're putting down religious people and you think you're like better than? How about spiritual pride? How about arrogance? How about not even following the big book? How about closed-mindedness? How about anything but Alcoholics Anonymous? If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, or a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride, you know, you want to say that I think atheists or agnostics or anything are bad things? No, no, but Dr. Bob did. Dr. Bob did, who Bill Wilson, by the way, looked up to. If you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or of any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. All he had was pity for those people. Your heavenly Father will never let you down. And so what is the problem he's talking about? Why are people like that if it doesn't have to do with false pride? If it doesn't have to do with people worrying about what other people in AA will think about them if they really surrender to what this book is talking about. In the back of your mind, worrying about if you do this and if I try this and if I go along with this, will they make fun of me at AA meetings? And you want to know something? Some people will. Some people will. I've been through it. You want to talk about this stuff at AA meetings? You'll have people walk out. You'll have people get mad at you. They'll scream at you. They'll be pissed off at you. You know what I mean? Well, I guess you have to develop something called courage. Don't you think? To be your own man. You know? I mean, it's easy to just go along and shut up and not talk about what's really going on and what the truth is. You understand what I'm saying? Just to placate the crowd because you're worried about being hurt. But, of course, that would be selfish and self-centered. And that would be anything but sober, right? You know, you might as well be drinking. That's not growing up. That's like being a 3-year-old thumb-sucking baby. And you don't want that. You want to go to the banquet. You want the real deal. You want the new freedom and the new happiness, right? You want all that stuff. You think you can, they say, rarely have a seen person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. You know, if you do what we did, you'll get what we got. You think you're going to be able to get what they got, the real good stuff they're talking about in here, the promises and the whole thing, seated with it, your relationship with him is right, and great events will come for pass for you and countless others. That's what it says. It says, we know but a little. God will constantly disclose for you. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Seated with it, your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You think you're going to have great events pass for you and countless others when you're ashamed of him? You think that's what the relationship with God is? You think that's the kind of relationship he wants, to have a relationship with somebody who's scared to talk about him because somebody might laugh at them? You think that has to do with a relationship with God? Saying, I'm spiritual, not religious? You know, you think that all has to do, or does it have to do with putting down God? Does it have to do with saying, I can do this thing on my own. I don't need God's help. I don't need to do this thing. Do you think that has to do with humility? Or do you think it has to do with arrogance? So next time you're trying to figure out whether there's even more surrenders, what did you have to do in order to even get your foot into Alcoholics Anonymous? You had to give up the ghost. You had to surrender your own way of thinking. You had to believe them when they said stop drinking. You had to believe them when they said go to meetings. You had to give up alcohol. You had to give up some of your friends. You had to give up stuff. You think that's the only surrender you have to make in AA to move forward? You think there aren't surrenders that have to go on? Now, you don't have to, but I don't think this is a dress rehearsal. You don't have to, but this is the only life I think you got. You know, you want to blow it because you're worried about what some goof in the front row thinks about you or whether they're going to laugh at you. You want to blow that deal because you're so chicken shit and you're so worried about what other people think about you that you want to do it, then you deserve what you get. You deserve a life of, you know, quiet, silent desperation. You don't deserve what they have. And you'll understand a little bit more when they talk about separating the man from the boys. And there is a separation. They wouldn't have written about it. They wouldn't have said there were men and there are boys. And what's the definition of a man? Somebody who's repeatedly trying to grow in the image likeness of his creator. The definition of everything in here that's worthwhile is based upon the standard set by God. About God. You know what the higher power is? It's something they mention in the second step before they get into the real deal. They mention the real deal all over 600 times in this book. They're not ashamed of it. Now, do we want a big funnel? Do we kick people out if they say they're an atheist? No, anybody's entitled to be here. You're entitled to be here. You know what? And I'm entitled to talk about what I've learned in 31 years of sobriety. I didn't come in here, you know, as a Bible thumper or, you know, or a believer or anything. Quite the opposite. I believe in Playboy bunnies, Ferraris, and, you know, and money. Neither do I sit around here and pander to the crowd and soften my story or change my testimony because I think some goof isn't going to like it. There are plenty of people in here that you can follow and you can listen to that'll talk quite the opposite of me and let you know that God isn't necessary. And in the end, in the next 10 years, there'll be a lot of people drinking. There'll be some people not drinking. There'll be a lot of people lonely and not full of joy. And there'll be some people that are going to be living the joy of living. And you can decide, you know, over a period of time, whether it's working for you or whether it's not working for you. You don't have to take my word for it. But don't let anybody tell you that nobody ever told you a different story. You know, in the book of Ezekiel, it talks about the watchmen. Old Testament stuff. They're going to have a Bible study after this. You guys ought to go to it. The Old Testament stuff. It says God appoints watchmen over the people. You know, and the bottom line is that, you know, the watchman's job is to tell one thing, just to warn and just tell the people this is the deal. That's what the Old Testament prophets were about. Just warning people this is the deal. And you know what the book says? What the book says is very interesting. It says if you don't warn the people, then their blood, even if they do stupid things, are on your hands. You warn the people, you know what I mean? They're responsible for their own thing. This book warns the people. This book is as clear. And the Dr. Bob and Good Old Timers, you can't be any clearer. You can't state it any clearer in this book. This book is as clear as my wife was when she says, you come home drunk one more time, I'll leave you. You know, I tell that story today and people laugh. You know why they laugh? For the same reason they laugh about the guy in the inner tube. How can you be so stupid? And this book is clear. This book says, you come home drunk one more time, you don't place all your trust in God, you're stupid. I feel sorry for you. Your heavenly Father will never let you down. And you know what happens? People walk away from this book and say, well, I wonder what they meant by that. And go on with their lives. They do the same thing, and it's just as much alcoholism when I walked away from my wife and I suffered the consequences. So God bless you. I'll see you next week.